From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. A manuscript, according to Oliver Herford, the English writer and illustrator, is something submitted in haste and returned at leisure. Herford's aphorism suggests the perils and rewards of documentary editing, that complicated process through which both popular and academic audiences come to know the primary sources for modern scholarship in history and literature. What is documentary editing? What are its ground rules, goals, and limitations? Soundings put those questions to two documentary editors and the director of a major university press, Robert Hill, Mary Jo Klein, and Herb Bailey. Robert Hill is the editor of the Marcus Garvey Papers, currently being published by the University of California Press. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Robert Hill worked on a biography of Marcus Garvey, the Jamaican black nationalist who created the Universal Negro Improvement Association. Mary Jo Klein is Assistant Vice President for Printed and Manuscript Americana at Sotheby's. She was co-editor of the Political Correspondence and Public Papers of Aaron Burr, published in 1984 by Princeton University Press. Herb Bailey has served for 30 years as the director of the Princeton University Press. During a recent visit to the National Humanities Center, Herb Bailey worked on a project about American publishing and the liberal arts. Mary Jo, let me begin with you. I understand that there's some discussion over what you mean when you say documentary editing. Is there a shorthand definition that you documentary editors have agreed on?
No, there's none. In modern American scholarship in the humanities, scholarly editing, which means preparing some kind of text that is reliable enough to be used for research by other scholars, such scholarly editing is generally done either by historians or by literary scholars. You do combine, or in technical terms, conflate, but you let the seams show. You don't leave a smooth reading text. You have footnotes that alert your reader to the fact that you've been doing something, so that what you present to the reader is as close as possible to what existed in some single form. It is a document. It can be used almost as reliably as the original.
Do you end up making more words than what you come to begin with, Bobby? For instance, in your Garvey papers, how much do you write, and are you fearful that what you write gets between your audience and Garvey?
In the practice of documentary editing, the two have to be explicitly separated. It's because there have been instances in some editions where you have had a brief letter of two or three paragraphs or two or three sentences with a page and a half of supporting explication. In other words, the explanation of the text becomes the tail wagging the dog, and it overwhelms the text. And particularly because of the constraints of money and resources to do this kind of annotating of text, there has been, I think, a backlash in the profession. Personally, I think it may have gone too far. I think that in the last few years, historical editors have, the pendulum has swung to the other extreme. Today, we are, by and large, looking for very spare annotation.
Bobby, in your editing of the Marcus Garvey papers, what is your aim?
I like to say that we are telling a story.
We, the editors.
Yes. Mm-hmm. The editor is telling a story. This determines the principles of selection. Let me give you an example. In the case of the Booker T. Washington papers, there are upwards of 1 million items in the Booker T. Washington papers, which are at the Library of Congress. The editor of that edition printed 13 volumes. They printed no more than about 5,000 items from a collection that has over 1 million items. You have to choose then against some rough idea of what the story is about, the story of Washington's life. And you're trying to tell as complete a story of Washington's life or the subject's life as the material allows you to and space permits. Where you have to limit your selection because of space requirements, you try to use and to deploy the information in your historical annotations of texts in order to keep before the reader aspects of the subject's career that you can't incorporate in the texts that are edited. So that historical annotation for selected letterpress editions has a dual purpose: to provide information, but also to enlarge upon the story that the selection of the texts themselves are unable to get at.
Herb Bailey.
What you say, Bob, illuminates, I think, a special advantage that the documentary editor has. That is, he really looks at all the documents, and it, as a result, he sometimes finds things that historians otherwise have simply overlooked. If the historian had had time, had had the occasion to really to look at all those documents carefully, he might have made the same discoveries. But it's simply in the nature of documentary editing to make new discoveries. In the Einstein papers, we have two important new Einstein manuscripts that have never been published, that will be published. I'd like to hear more from Mary Jo Klein about the famous cipher letter on which Aaron Burr was convicted in his treason trial, and because I know that she discovered some things about that, and she's the one who should tell us about it. And she made the discoveries as a result of her historical work. I'm not sure I have that exactly correct, Mary Jo. Correct me if I have got it wrong.
Aaron Burr was not convicted. He was never convicted of anything. Indicted, yes. Accused, yes. But not convicted. Although, like Marcus Garvey, he did spend some time in jail awaiting trial. The cipher letter to which Herb referred raised all sorts of editorial questions once we'd finally figured out what it was. It was a letter addressed to James Wilkinson, one of the truly sleazy characters in American history, who was commanding the American Army in the West in the summer of 1806. Wilkinson received this letter in the Mississippi Territory. It was in cipher. After delaying a few weeks, Wilkinson sent a dispatch to Washington announcing to President Jefferson that he had received news that there was some conspiracy afoot in the West. And the weeks that followed, Wilkinson became more explicit about what he had heard, finally admitting to Jefferson that he had received a cipher letter, then saying that it was from Burr. Burr was eventually arrested, brought to Richmond, put in the Richmond Penitentiary that had been designed by his friend Benjamin Henry Latrobe a few years earlier, and tried for treason and conspiracy before Justice John Marshall. Burr was acquitted, found it prudent to leave for Europe not long afterwards, and disappeared as a force in American public life. Well, this is the most famous Burr letter. We became convinced quite early that Burr had never written the letter. In order to make it seem like a letter from Burr, Wilkinson had modified the deciphering so that references to Burr in the third person became I and me. We then had to figure out who could have written the letter. Fortunately, the copy that Wilkinson had actually received in Mississippi still survived in the collections at the Newbery Library in Chicago. And we stared at those photocopies for weeks. We compared the handwriting with all of Aaron Burr's secretaries or associates who might have written the letter for him. There was no match in handwriting. I drafted an increasingly incoherent introductory note for this letter. The time was coming close to send the copy to Princeton University Press to be set in type. And one evening, as I sat at home knitting, without any of the manuscripts nearby, I forced myself to think of who might have written the letter. Obviously someone who corresponded with James Wilkinson, since they both had the key to this cipher. Someone who had some association with Burr and could write with some authority, if not complete truth, about what Burr was doing, where he was going. And it also had to be someone whose identity Aaron Burr wouldn't disclose, because Aaron Burr at the time protested that he had not written the letter, but he never hinted as to who might have written this letter. And that brought me very quickly to one name, Jonathan Dayton, close friend of Aaron Burr's, close friend of James Wilkinson. Jonathan Dayton was indicted along with Burr for conspiracy. Burr could not implicate Dayton without implicating himself. But I came to this conclusion sitting at home. I managed to get to my office at the New York Historical Society at 8 o'clock the next morning to start pulling out samples of Dayton's handwriting. And it was the same. And no one had bothered to look at the handwriting before. And if I had not had to write some kind of introductory note, I might have passed it off with a vague introduction. But because I had to write something that made sense, I had to spend the extra couple of hours knitting and thinking.
The phrase scholar adventurer or detective comes to my mind. Do you think of yourself in that capacity?
Oh, yes. I'm a terrible snoop. I read all of Edgar Allan Poe's tales when I was 9 years old. I read detective fiction constantly. We're all snoops. That's why we have fun doing it.
Herb Bailey.
As a publisher, I am constantly impressed with the discoveries that are made by documentary editors. They aren't just transcribing documents. They're digging for documents. They're looking in Europe. They're looking in libraries. They're looking in attics for documents. In the Einstein Papers, as I mentioned earlier, we have recently, and by we, I mean the editors, not I myself, have discovered a manuscript written in 1912, which is the most thorough description of the theory of special relativity that Einstein wrote. He wrote it halfway between the discovery of the special relativity and the discovery of general relativity, and therefore it has special significance in showing the transitions of his thought. We've discovered a manuscript written in 1919, an exposition of the theory of general relativity for the public. That was the year in which he suddenly became world famous because of the observation of the bending of light around the sun by Sir Arthur Eddington. Also, very recently, and I think this is almost quite amusing, some new documents were found having to do with his record as a student in high school. There has been a legend about Einstein. There are many legends about Einstein, but this one in particular is that as a young man, he was a very poor student. And this apparently stemmed from the fact that his report cards went along and he was getting good grades for a while and then suddenly got very poor grades. Well, what the people who had interpreted this didn't know, and what was discovered by the documentary editors, is that the school reversed its method of grading at one point, so that what looked like very poor grades were actually very high grades. And except for the subject of French, in which he did have some trouble, Einstein was an extremely good student.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a conversation about the art of documentary editing and modern American scholarship. The Soundings panelists are two documentary editors and the director of a university press, Robert Hill, Mary Jo Klein, and Herb Bailey. Robert Hill is a professor at the University of California at Los Angeles, where he serves as editor of the Marcus Garvey Papers, currently being published by the University of California Press. During a recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Robert Hill worked on a biography of Marcus Garvey, the Jamaican black nationalist. Mary Jo Klein is Assistant Vice President for Printed and Manuscript Americana at Sotheby's. She was co-editor of the political correspondence and public papers of Aaron Burr, published in 1984 by Princeton University Press. Herb Bailey has served as director of the Princeton University Press for 30 years. During a recent visit to the National Humanities Center, Herb Bailey worked on a project about American publishing and the liberal arts. Here is Robert Hill.
I'd like to be specific and say that, first of all, the editions that are being prepared in the area of Afro-American history are, first of all, recovering a vast quantity of material. In recovering this material, we are preserving an important and a significant part of the record of Afro-American history. Just the sheer preservation value of what the projects are doing is of the greatest importance. But secondly, the projects that are underway, such as the Frederick Douglass papers at Yale, the Black Abolitionist papers, which are at Florida State University, the Freedom and Southern Society papers, the Booker T. Washington papers, and the Marcus Garvey papers. We are, in terms of chronological span, spanning an era from about the 1830s to 1940. This is just a very important part of the experience of blacks in American history. Therefore, when you put them back to back, these are major editions. They are portraits not only of the individuals whose names are listed in the titles of these editions, but they are portraits of significant eras in American and Afro-American history. My feeling is that as a result of the abolitionist papers and the Frederick Douglass papers, it will not be possible to write antebellum black history in the way that it had been written before. With the Freedom and Southern Society papers project, it's not going to be possible to write the history of the black role in the Civil War and blacks in Reconstruction the same anymore. And in the case of the Booker T. Washington papers and the Marcus Garvey papers, what we are going to see is a whole new interpretation emerge in the understanding of black intellectual history, black popular political history. Therefore, putting them back to back, I can see for our generation, Afro-American history undergoing a considerable revision.
Mary Jo, let me follow Bobby's comments and put a question to you. Did that sense, or the sense of what, urgency, of really doing something new and opening up a kind of new historical frontier from the standpoint of a documentary editor, did that enter into your efforts with Aaron Burr, or is this a sort of an apples and oranges kind of thing here?
It's apples and oranges. The additions that Bobby mentioned were the result of a very conscious effort to move documentary editing from its traditional role in publishing the papers of what were called the Great White Fathers. And it was just about 10 years ago that historians, not only in the field of Afro-American history, but in the history of labor relations, of economic movements, made a very forceful demand that the money that had heretofore been concentrated on the papers of great white men be spread around. And it's only now that we're beginning to see the fruits of meeting that demand, not only with the additions that are relevant to Afro-American history, but we'll soon see the first volumes of the Samuel Gompers papers. And there are differences in editing such papers. There's the problem of definition of the papers that are to be edited. rightly or wrongly, traditional editors of the papers of great white men thought that they could define the papers of Thomas Jefferson or James Madison or John Adams as pieces of paper usually written by or directed to that central figure. The papers of Marcus Garvey are officially on the title page of the two handsome volumes that have recently appeared, the Marcus Garvey and Universal Negro Improvement Association papers. Although the Booker T. Washington volumes are called the Booker T. Washington papers, they are indeed the records of Booker T. Washington and Tuskegee. Even when one of these projects centers on an individual, as with Garvey or Booker T. Washington or Frederick Douglass or Samuel Gompers, the editors must recognize that these men, still men, can be judged historically only as part of widespread movements that they initiated or took over, but movements in which thousands of other people participated. And so the problems of collection are much greater, the problems of selection are much more complicated, and the problems of annotation become sometimes nightmarish.
Herb Bailey, tell me, what's the role of the publisher? What's happening with all of the technological explosions that surround us? Video discs and various forms of tape and transcription?
Yes. Mary Jo Klein said at the beginning that modern historical editing really began when it became possible to make copies. The first copies for the Jefferson papers were made by the same machine that was used to make V-mail for soldiers in World War II. But the most important and helpful thing is simply the transfer of what the editor has done in his office into type without having to re-keyboard. Because the computer practically never makes mistakes. And if the editor is satisfied with what he or she has in the computer, that can then be run into a typesetting machine, and you get out something that is essentially correct, reducing the proofreading time. I don't think the printed book as we know it is going to disappear, but the very fact that we have the book in computer will make it possible for scholars to use the computer in the same way that the editor uses the computer to find out things that would otherwise be difficult to find out. There is a further way that the modern techniques will help, and that is by enabling a publisher to extract material and to produce popular editions. One can simply take the letters, say, between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, and have the computer select all those letters, bring them together in chronological order, and print them out. To do that in the old-fashioned way would be a rather large and expensive job. We are already doing popular editions, of course, of some of these volumes, more particularly the literary volumes. But I think that the flexibility of a computer is going to allow publishers to be much more imaginative in selecting from these huge editions certain parts that will be of broad public interest.
Bobby, did you have a comment?
I like to say that the documentary editor is an archaeologist of documentary remains. Hmm. The documentary editor has as his principal or her principal function the recovery and the preservation and the restoration of a civilization's documentary record. It's no different from that of the archivist or the manuscript librarian, except that the documentary editor has to make this much more accessible and process this that in a way that makes the best use of all available knowledge, so that these texts are not simply passive. They don't remain buried away in some archival storage box. They are recreated almost from their original environment and made to live again. The documentary editor has a great responsibility to recover and to preserve and to disseminate a civilization's documentary record.
Mary Jo?
In disseminating this record, we're trying to share a past, and I think that we are the documentary editors generally of our populist historians. We desperately want people to read these editions. We desperately want them to become as excited as we are about finding out what really happened in the barest terms of evidence. And for that reason, we welcome anything that makes the editions cheaper, more available, more widely read, because of our commitment to sharing this excitement and sharing whatever wisdom we get from finding out what it was like.
Herb?
This is a question which I have asked myself many times, not only about documentary editions, but about the many kinds of specialized books that we at Princeton University Press and other university presses publish. I think the answer is most easily seen if one supposes that these books simply didn't exist, that we didn't know very much about our history, or what we knew was wrong, was something that had been concocted and had been changed by legend over a period of time. I think that we understand ourselves better by understanding our past. I think we understand our times better by understanding what happened in the recent and more distant past. And to me, this is immensely valuable. Not that history is going to repeat itself, but that it gives us a basis on which to judge and to see ourselves.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a discussion about the art of documentary editing and modern American scholarship. The Soundings panelists were Robert Hill, editor of the Marcus Garvey Papers, published by the University of California Press; Mary Jo Klein, assistant vice president for Printed and Manuscript Americana at Sotheby's; and Herb Bailey, director of the Princeton University Press. Next week, Soundings on Documentary Scholarship continues with a conversation about documentary photography and modern literature. The Soundings panelists will be Jefferson Hunter of Smith College and Alex Harris of Duke University. For a cassette copy of Soundings on the Art of Documentary Editing, send $3 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me this week for a conversation about the art of documentary editing, the complex process through which both popular and academic audiences come to know the primary sources for modern scholarship in history and literature. What is documentary editing? Its ground rules, goals, and limitations. Two documentary editors and the director of the Princeton University Press have some answers and insights. Documentary Editing, this week on Soundings from the National Humanities Center on this station.